Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM in Troy and WOOSLP 98.9 FM in Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, the Delaware River Basin Commission is poised to decide on a massive liquefied natural gas transport project. Then on this week's episode of Reclaiming History, my co-host Livonia Mallory explores her own family's encounter with the police. After that, an episode of People Science with the Sanctuary's own Water Justice Fellows, and then we'll look at the effects of New York State cuts to mental health, disabled, and other vulnerable populations. And we'll close out the show with a discussion of architecture, both ancient and modern, with architect David Biggs. But first, here are today's headlines.
Sitting across from her lawyer at Immigration Detention Center in rural Georgia, Melinda Carpenter Fernandez unbuttons her jail jumpsuit to show the scars on her abdomen. There were three small circular marks. An unauthorized sterilization was performed on this woman. Congressional Democrats have called for an investigation into the Erwin County Detention Center. It's true, if true, the appalling conditions described in the whistleblower complaint, including allegations of mass hysterectomies being performed on vulnerable immigrant women, are staggering abuses of human rights, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said in a statement on September 15th.
U.S. health officials on Friday dropped a controversial piece of coronavirus guidance and said anyone who has been in close contact with an infected person should get tested. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention essentially returned to its previous testing guidance, getting rid of language posted last month that said people didn't need to get tested if they didn't feel sick. That change has set off a rash of criticism from health experts who couldn't fathom why the nation's top public health agency would say such a thing amid the pandemic. That was reported by the AP.
The city council will vote to install 120 street surveillance cameras in the wake of an 11-year-old, Ashawn Davis, who was killed in a drive-by shooting Sunday. The city administration will have a contract ready for a council vote on October 1st to approve installation of new street camera surveillance system. Council President Carmela Metello said Thursday night during a special council meeting, this project, which was in the works before the killing of Ashawn Davis, would replace decade-old system that no longer functions completely and has left holes in finding visual evidence on various crimes.
Albany County reported 25 new cases of COVID on Thursday, with 18 associated with the University of Albany. The Daily Gazette reports that a handful of school districts across the capital region, including East Greenbush, have experienced at least one COVID-19 case in recent days as students return to school and districts start reopening start reporting infection data on a regular basis.
Shortly after being sued by the teachers union, Governor Cuomo agreed to reverse its policy on withholding 20% of the local school aid adopted in the state budget. Much of the funds will be diverted to the teachers' pension fund. Cuomo had been using the threat to cut school aid to pressure Trump and Congress to approve a federal stimulus package. Many school districts have already slashed programs and laid off hundreds of state workers. As temperatures begin to dip, area restaurants are struggling to continue their outdoor food service as long as possible due to the COVID-19 crisis. Indoor dining is limited to 50% of capacity, and outdoor services has accounted for the bulk of the restaurant business since they reopened. New York's unemployment rate fell to 12.5% in August and 15.9% in July as the state gained private sector jobs for the fourth straight month. Unemployment remains the highest in New York at 16%, well above the national rate of 8.4%. A new study says that New York nursing homes, where workers are represented by labor unions, had 30% fewer COVID-19 deaths and 42% less infection than those without union representation.
Albany County. The Times Union reports that two members of the state attorney general's office testified Thursday that former Rensselaer County District Attorney Joel Avalov and Troy Police stonewalled their requests for information after the 2016 police shooting of Edson Thevenin. The testimony came on the third day of Avalov's perjury and official misconduct trial in Rensselaer County Court. Prosecutors for Attorney General Letitia James contend Avalov, who served as Rensselaer County's top prosecutor from 2014 to 2018, rushed the case through the grand jury that cleared Sergeant Randall French of any criminal wrongdoing in Thevenin's death.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, but I'm still on my couch.
And I'm glad that you're staying safe there on your couch, Livonia, though I miss you in the studio so much. And our mission, if you don't know, is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary Sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390. A massive liquefied natural gas infrastructure project could export LNG overseas if it is built. And we go now to my interview with Food and Water Watch, where we discuss the project. An unprecedented plan to transport liquefied natural gas is being proposed in the northeastern United States. Mark Ruffalo recently brought attention to the project before a September 10th meeting of the Delaware River Basin Commission.
Okay, the fracking industry has reached a total new level of insanity and corruption, everybody. They're trying to transport liquefied fracked gas by trucks and old rail cars down the Delaware River, which supplies the drinking water for 15 million people. The liquefied gas is so explosive that 22 rail cars would have the same force as a Hiroshima bomb. Now, this crazy Trump-backed plan has moved forward in total secrecy without any serious study or public comment, despite grave concerns by medical experts and environmentalists. But what's even more crazy is that the four Democratic governors of New Jersey, New York, Delaware, and Pennsylvania are poised to go along with this plan this Thursday at a meeting of the Delaware River Basin Commission. Please, let's stop this craziness. Sign the petition to stop it at moveon.org/Delaware River.
So obviously that meeting that Mark Ruffalo was referring to took place on September 10th. And to discuss this project, we're joined now by Jocelyn Sawyer, the South Jersey organizer with Food and Water Watch and Food and Water Action. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Jocelyn.
Thank you so much for having me.
What was on the agenda at that meeting of the Delaware River Basin Commission on September 10th, and what was the outcome?
So this project was first brought before the Delaware River Commission, last year. And they're really, just as, you know, as Mark Ruffalo said in the video, there was a lot of secrecy surrounding this. What was initially before the DRBC was a docket for their approval about constructing a dock as part of an export terminal in Gibbstown, New Jersey. And through, you know, digging on the part of Food and Water Action, other environmental advocacy groups, we discovered that this is just one piece in a puzzle for this massive fracked gas plan that's about exporting liquefied fracked gas from Pennsylvania overseas, and that was actually the material that was going to be transported and exported from this port. But the LNG aspects was hidden from the public. And so last year, the Delaware River Basin Commission, which is the agency that's tasked with protecting the environment in the Delaware River Basin, they approved that docket to move forward with the construction of this dock at this port, without really disclosing the fracked gas element and without considering the entire cradle-to-grave environmental impacts of the project. And so our friends at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, another environmental advocacy group, they brought a legal challenge against that decision, that decision was not right because the full impacts of the project weren't considered. And this past spring, we testified, members of the public, residents in the area testified at DRBC to make the case that this needed to be reconsidered. And so at this past meeting, they were revisiting that decision to approve this project. We were expecting a decision, and actually what ended up happening was that the DRBC decided they need more time to go over all of the testimony and the evidence and consider, and so they postponed a vote. So we're kind of still in limbo about whether this project is going to be permitted by the DRBC. But what they also did is they voted to pause construction, that the company that is trying to build this project, New Fortress Energy, Delaware River Partners, they can't begin construction until a review has been conducted, which was great news. And so we had New Jersey and New York and Delaware representatives on the DRBC voted in favor of hitting pause on that construction till a review can be completed. The federal representative from the Army Corps of Engineers voted against that, voted to move ahead with construction, and the representative from Pennsylvania abstained.
Jocelyn, can you explain what liquefied natural gas is and what makes it so dangerous?
Yeah, so liquefied natural gas, it is fracked gas that has been super cooled to a liquid state, super cooled actually to negative 259 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's highly volatile, very explosive. And since it is super cooled, if there is a train or truck accident, if that gas is released, it immediately expands into a cloud of heavy, cold vapor. And if the vapor is ignited, it can ignite into a fire that is so hot that it can't be put out. It burns even hotter than a lot of fuels. The vapor cloud can travel. It can travel before igniting. It can cause asphyxiation. If that vapor cloud is allowed to settle in areas that are populated, it's just the potential for disaster with this substance is huge. It is definitely not something that we want transported down busy highways and through populated communities in Pennsylvania and New Jersey.
So really, this project is unprecedented. Transporting liquefied natural gas, also called LNG, by rail, by truck, to export. Can you tell us about New Fortress Energy and their intention in the fracked gas market? Why are they pushing this project forward?
At this point, I mean, the fracking industry is really not profitable. And in fact, there has been such a frenzy of fracking in this country that we have a huge gas glut. There is way more supply than demand. And so natural gas prices have plummeted, and that is not good news for frackers. And so what we've been seeing is that the fracking industry is turning to even, you know, newer, wilder schemes just to try to make a profit. And they're really turning right now towards exports, and specifically trying to export gas overseas to be turned into plastics. And that's really what this project is about, what New Fortress Energy is trying to do. It's creating this project that's shipping gas from Pennsylvania, processing it in a facility up in Bradford County, northeastern Pennsylvania, is their intention. And then they want to transport it down to Gibbstown by truck or rail, and then export it overseas. So it doesn't have anything to do with energy in this region. It's just about trying to boost profits for the fracking industry. It really, the steps of permitting and approving this project, it's been like a death by a thousand cuts. It's been, you know, an air quality permit application that crops up here, or this docket that was put before the Delaware River Basin Commission about asking their approval to construct this dock at this export terminal that didn't even mention anything about, you know, that they're going to be shipping liquefied natural gas, this hugely volatile, dangerous substance, into this port. And so, yeah, it really has been a process of just needing to piece together the whole story and trying to get the word out to the public so that, you know, people living in this area understand what actually is coming forward.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jocelyn Sawyer, the South Jersey organizer with Food and Water Watch and Food and Water Action. How was New Fortress Energy able to get approval to ship liquefied natural gas by rail cars?
This is actually a very specific, special thing that President Trump has decided to allow. So in April 2019, Trump issued an executive order calling on the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, PHMSA, to approve rail cars for transporting liquefied natural gas on a very tight timeline. And that is not something that had been done, that is typically done. And so there is a rushed process to approve these rail cars. And very soon after that executive order, actually by the end of last year, New Fortress Energy's subsidiary had been approved to transport liquefied natural gas by rail, specifically along this route for this project. So, you know, it really seems like this is a part of the Trump energy agenda, that he is working with the fracking industry to push these new avenues for profits, just wilder and even more reckless things to do with natural gas.
So there's increasing evidence that the fracking industry has a lot of political power, a lot of lobbying power. It seems very David and Goliath. Do these four governors have the power to stop this project on the basis that it is against, you know, stopping the world from burning up in climate crisis?
We believe that they do. They certainly could, you know, make the choice to have their representatives on the Delaware River Basin Commission deny this project on the grounds that increasing fracking in this region would not be good for the health of the river basin. Just actually today in New Jersey, there was a law signed allowing the state DEP to take environmental justice into consideration when considering new, like, dirty energy and polluting projects, and to really be able to look at the cumulative impacts and consider a wider array of impacts of these projects. But we do believe that, I mean, for instance, that Governor Murphy would have the power to enact a moratorium on fossil fuels, and that it really is in the hands of these four governors.
You just heard Jocelyn Sawyer, organizer for Food and Water Watch and Food and Water Action. Again, for more information on fracking and fracking infrastructure, visit foodandwaterwatch.org. So you can keep track of them secretly trying to change our environment.
And up next, we have a segment by my co-host, Lavonia Mallory. In this segment, she gets personal as she explores her own family's encounters with the Albany police, with over 60 years of being Albany locals. In one touching part of the story, her Uncle Bill describes the death of his grandmother at the age of 10, when the Albany police intruded on the family at the moment of his beloved grandmother's death. This is Reclaiming History.
Once again, welcome to another segment of Reclaiming History, airing on WOOC 105.3 FM, The Sanctuary. This is Lavonia Mallory, and I'm at a family gathering here on Labor Day weekend. And like so many Black families that come together, sometimes our gatherings become an opportunity to sit around the kitchen table and to talk politics. And members of my family are talking about their experience of growing up in Albany, New York. All of my family has lived in the Albany area since the Great Migration, when many Blacks fleeing Jim Crow segregation in the South came up to work in the factories in the North. And my family experience is no different. But my family also talks about the collective tragedy of police violence against Black people.
He was the ninth president. Andrew Jackson was the eighth president. So Uncle William, I have a question for you. I want you to tell me about some of the people that when you were young that got beat up or harassed by the police in Albany, New York, as far as you can remember.
Let me see, Donald Mitchell. Donald Mitchell didn't get beat up. He saw a friend of ours, John Harris, get beat up, and his mother and father wouldn't let him testify against the cops.
And you were talking about people who actually got shot by the police.
Billy Brown, on the corner of Green Street and Herkimer. Yeah, Green and Herkimer. And he was shot in between Herkimer and Franklin Street.
Did he live?
Oh, he died about 4 days later in Albany Medical Center. That was in, 58. No, it was 50. It had to be 59 or 60. That's right.
And you talked about another person who was in the military.
Floyd Teasley. He was in the Air Force. And he, and the cops beat him, Albany cops beat him terribly. A Rodney King type beating. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, that was common, the cops that beat people and disregard them. I remember when my grandmother died, and I lived upstairs on the third floor, and she was on the first floor. And my aunt called me, sister called me, says, "Mama's dead." We all ran downstairs. We start crying. The next thing you know, the cops busted in. We didn't call the cops. I didn't say a goddamn word. Strut around, looked and left. And I remember my grandma was dead with her mouth open. And she had a sliver of saliva. And I remember that.
Anybody else killed by the police that you can recall?
Not offhand. Not those are the ones I knew. There have been other people. A lot of people, they would beat people up all the time. Going back to, I remember what happened.
So you were also talking earlier about someone that the police shot him and then shot up the bar or something.
Same incident with Billy Brown. They were shooting indiscriminately. There's bullet holes in the window, just like on Gangbusters. Mm-hmm. It was lucky some other people wasn't shot.
All right, Ma, now it's your turn. So do you recall anybody being beat up or shot by the police in your lifetime, being a lifetime Albanian?
The same thing that Babe talked about, my brother talked about. I know all those situations, except once they were hitting on my father. Daddy had seizures, and somebody came to the house, I can't remember who that was, and said, "Nubby, you better get down there. The police are beating on Lonnie." I said, "Daddy." So I tracked it on down. I was flying down Madison Avenue. I get there, he was raising his stick, and he hit Daddy on the bottom of the foot. I said, "Don't." I just ran up to him. I said, don't you hit him again. You better not hit him. I was old. Lord have mercy. I looked at him.
He had a seizure, right?
Yeah, he had a seizure.
Yeah.
So he said, "Well, he's drunk." I said, "God is not drunk. He has seizures."
From what you're telling me, you two know of at least, in your memory, at least three occasions where the Albany police, based on your memory, shot them. As you can hear, this is a family gathering, and I think my family is no different than most Black families. We come together to celebrate, but we all have an experience with police brutality that is just part and parcel with being Black in America. Being Black in America means being stopped and frisked, stopped while driving, stopped while shopping, stopped while mowing your lawn, shopped while selling papers, shopped while going into your own apartment, shopped while being in your own apartment. These are all the experiences of being Black in America. Thank you for tuning in to another segment of Reclaiming History with Livonia Mallory, airing on WOOC, the Sanctuary for Independent Media.
I got that.
That was just my own story. Alexis, I tried not to air this. I looked for every other segment I could possibly do. But I think of the world of the situation in South Africa for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That country could have exploded into bloody war, but they avoided it because of their willingness to share. And Desmond Tutu said it this way: forgiveness is not just personally rewarding. It is a political necessity. Forgiveness allowed South Africans to imagine a new beginning, one based on honesty, peace, and compassion. And so I felt like I wanted to share, and I'm sure there are other people out there listening to this who have similar stories. And if we can just share, maybe we can move beyond this and really truly come to a place of peace. For those of you just listening, I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
The programs cover stories and social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. Thank you all, and we thank all of our volunteers and our sanctuary sustainers. You can hear all about the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org. Okay, next, HMM producer Aaron Blanding speaks with Nature Lab Water Justice Fellow Gabby about their roles in fighting for water justice for everyone and everything.
This is Aaron Blanding, and today I'm talking with the Water Justice Youth about their work and these interesting times that we're living in. So thanks for joining me today, you guys.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, just to get started, if we could have like intros, you guys tell me your name, maybe what grade you're in and what got you into this work.
Starting off with me, my name is Genesis Cooper. I am 14 years old and I'm going into the ninth grade. What got me interested in water justice was doing work at the sanctuary in the summer of 2019. And then Miss Branda, who is one of the coordinators of water justice, she like got me into the program and told me all of the things about it. And I have a big interest in science, so I've just joined.
Nice.
I'm Gabby. I'm the youngest, 13 years old. I'm going to be a freshman. And I joined the Youth Justice Program because I'm very interested in marine biology, and I hope to pursue it when I go to college.
My name is Shantanique Pollock. I am,
how old am I?
15 years old, and I am going into the 10th grade. I got into water justice because Genesis like introduced me into it, and I've always kind of been into investigating stuff and researching and mostly science in general, so I thought it would be a really cool idea to join.
Awesome. That's really cool. And so, you know, I'm wondering if you could just tell everyone listening about just a little bit about the Water Justice Lab and what each of you are doing with the project.
So for all of us, really, we're basically researching different things about the Hudson River's water quality and how it can affect the people that live around it. I mostly focus around the animals that live around it.
I focus on, when I try to do interviews, I try to focus on people who affect, I guess you could say, the river's quality. So like landfill workers or just like random people around the neighborhood, maybe people who have a program for water justice similar to ours.
For me, I mostly focus on the sewage pollution and things that can easily come from like runoff into the river. So whenever I go into an interview, they'll mostly be about how to fix the sewage and the overflows, mostly.
Gotcha. Well, that it's really cool to hear you talk about, because this is really important work. In the larger, you know, in the grand scheme of things, water justice is really, really important. And I'm wondering, what does water justice mean to each of you guys?
I believe, I said this earlier, water justice is really just like in the name. It's like we focus, our base is water, and then the justice part of it is where we try to get justice for all people who are affected by water, people and animals and plants. It's just like justice for everybody, and the base is just water.
Water justice is important because, we need water to survive. And if, like, we didn't have clean water, then there would be health issues on top of health issues, and eventually there would be no more water.
For me, water justice is important because environmental things like water and even air and other things that we use to survive should be simple, like, necessities that we shouldn't have a problem with but are. So I think that, like, one of the, like, pretty much the mission of it is to make it so we no longer have to worry about things that should have been, like, clean and, like, available to everyone since the beginning.
So you guys are working on this during a very interesting time in our history, and pretty awful in terms of, you know, just some of the things that are happening. And I'm just wondering if you guys could talk about maybe how you guys see your work with water justice tying into, like, the grand scheme of, like, you know, maybe COVID or the Black Lives Matter movement that's, you know, seen a recent resurgence. So,
well, I think that water justice ties into the Black Lives Matter movement with the sense of environmental racism, mm-hmm. and how different areas, like, based on their income or based on who the majority race is in that said area, they can have different water quality. And it's not like that for every single neighborhood that has minorities, but it is like that for a good portion. So it just adds to another thing that the Black Lives Matter movement could be fighting for, more than just police brutality, but it could also be the health effects with environmental racism.
And another thing is, like, finding common ground, like, both the Black Lives Matter movement and the Water Justice Lab want to fight for equality for all and making the world a better place, whether that be with having a healthy water system, or all races having equal rights or being treated the same. So just in the sense of finding common ground could be another way that they related.
For about, like, the COVID issues that are going on, how the COVID situation and water justice kind of link together is, like, people's health, which also Genesis and Gabby added on to with the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. But pretty much with water, if it's unclean and dirty and people are still drinking out of it and going into it, your health will definitely be affected, and it shouldn't. Water shouldn't be something that can make you sick when it could easily be avoided.
Gotcha.
Yeah, those are some really good points. And so, you know, you kind of already touched on this a little bit earlier, but, you know, just a little more explicitly, what would you share your thoughts on what environmental equity for all means and, you know, what it might look like?
Environmental equity for all is, like I said earlier, where it's like equality in water quality when it comes to animals, plants, and humans. Because animals need water just as much as humans do. Plants need water just as much as animals do. Every life form on Earth needs water. So when all of us have good water, good, clean, healthy drinking and washing water, cooking water, it is beneficial to everybody, and it helps with health It can also help with the economy, because then there's not as many plumbing issues that happen with people's water. So people aren't spending as much to get their water fixed. So if we all just work together and try to make our water clean for every single being on Earth, it will reach true water equity.
And it's kind of adding on to what Genesis said, it could also be the fact of, like she said, all living things need water to survive, but water should be something that gives people strength instead of ruining their health and taking people down slowly. And we shouldn't have to be, like, people shouldn't be so clueless about their own water system, like where what they throw away goes, or where or how what steam factories are using, because air pollution and water pollution are all very big problems. So they could very well just end the human race altogether if it continues. So that's a really big problem.
Yeah. Adding on to what Gabby said, for like how water can slowly like kill people, I think that everyone should have access to water, but also this water should be clean. Like how some water drains and like water access people have are extremely dirty and unclean, but if you go a little bit more upstream, it'll be cleaner and more healthy. So I'm thinking that all water should be more healthy and drinkable and swimmable, and all the animals in it should be healthy as well.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's a really important distinction to make. And it's really awesome work you guys are doing, and really inspiring. This has been Erin Blanding, and I've talked with the Water Justice crew today about, you know, their work and water justice in general. And thanks for tuning in.
That was Erin Blanding with Nature Lab Water Justice Fellows Genesis, Nikki, Gabby about their roles in fighting for water justice for everyone and everything.
Up next, Harvey Rosenthal is the CEO of the New York State Association of Psychiatric Rehabilitation Services. He speaks about the impact of New York State budget cuts to mental health, disabled, and other vulnerable populations with Michelle Masurjan, the Upstate Housing Correspondent.
Good day, all. This is Michelle Masurjan for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, and my guest today is Harvey Rosenthal, Chief Executive Officer of the New York State Association of Psychiatric Rehabilitation Services. Welcome, Mr. Rosenthal.
Thank you, Michelle. Nice to be here.
I understand the New York State Office for Persons with Developmental Disabilities, or OPWDD, has initiated cuts to the housing subsidy for disabled persons starting October 2nd. How are disabled persons going to make up this shortfall in their rent payment, and how is this going to impact families who have to support their disabled family members?
Sure. I'm more involved with mental health, so I deal more with the Office of Mental Health, although the circumstances are the same. In the Office of Mental Health, they fund a lot. I think we fund about 40,000 beds, we call them, in New York. Many of them are apartments with rent stipends and staff that come visit people. And yes, those stipends are the ones that come from state monies that are in jeopardy because of the gap. So, you know, there is a threat all across the board, not only to rent stipends, but you name it, schools, fire departments, mental health treatment, mental health, you know, recovery, addiction recovery services, anything that's funded with state dollars. So we're all on the hook right now, waiting to see how things play out in Washington and in Albany. And we're not waiting. I just want to correct that. We are working really hard, advocating, lobbying, doing interviews like this, working together, you know, with the executive branch and the legislative branch. So this is the biggest threat we've had. I've been an advocate now for 25 years, and I've worked in the field for 40, and I've really never seen threats of this size and magnitude at the worst time, during a time when our services are most needed. So
for the short term, if you're a mental health person and you have a, you know, a case manager, or you're a disabled person, How are these cuts going to impact the operations of these programs?
Well, I actually think in some cases, even though the cuts haven't been, lasting cuts have not been levied. We'll know about that a bit later. But right now we have these things called withholds, which are not actually implemented cuts there, but they're the threat of cuts. They're the kind of cut that says we're going to hold money back, but we'll give it back to you if the federal government reimburses us. But the federal government's at a standstill. So people are sitting there with this impending 20% cut. Some agencies have gone ahead and already cut staff. They've let staff go. They've cut back on services. And I assume the caseloads have gone up, but it'll get much worse. Right now, people are anticipating they're taking some action, but we haven't been hit with an actual cut. If Washington doesn't deliver the money in the COVID relief package that's the subject of all this, of conflict down there, then the governor could very well turn these withholds into cuts of 20% or more. And that's when we'd really have to go to the legislature and look for support for, you know, for raising revenues.
So some of the recommendations in raising revenue to offset these pending budget cuts to the most vulnerable would be imposing greater taxes on New York's wealthy residents. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's definitely got to be on the table. There's some very serious money there. I think one of the revenues you could raise from appropriating money from the stock transfer tax is $13 billion, which is the gap. So there's a lot of ways we can approach it, but certainly tax hikes are the simplest. And I think it was yesterday, New Jersey raised their taxes on the wealthy. So where New York is wise to look over the river there and consider the same.
Does New York have a constitutional obligation to adequately provide for New Yorkers with disabilities?
We do here in New York, and I think we've seen the evidence of that. A couple of months ago, there were Medicaid cuts and to hospitals and nursing homes, but not to mental health programs, you know, for that reason. But I think that protection won't hold up and fight off this kind of financial pressure. They will be able. I think the governor will be able to do something here. There's a debate about how much and how much his authority is, and whether his authority is higher than the legislature, because that's the debate that happened this week. The state teachers union sued the governor on this grounds that he didn't have the constitutional authority, and he backed off imposing cuts in education. So we're encouraged that he'll do the same with us. And that will give us some time, Michelle, to see what happens in Washington. We're told, the election is coming. I doubt that Congress wants to run having cut all these services because they held on to the money in Washington. They didn't supply money to the states and localities. So we're hopefully expecting some sort of a break in the stalemate as the election becomes closer. And so we would hope at that point that we would see the money that would come to New York and that would offset these kinds of cuts.
And if these cuts don't come, because I've noticed that almost every year there's some cut to mental health and, you know, disability services. Like, this is sure. Really nothing new.
Right.
So with every year there being cuts, are we down, are these organizations down to their bare bones?
I think they are, but not because so much of the cuts. It's that there have been no increases for so long that the price of doing business and, of operating funds and the price index and things like that. I think we've been faced with cuts, but generally, we work at the legislature and many of them are restored. But the real threat here is the fact that we haven't gotten any increases in like 10 years. So what business is able to operate with, without an increase for a 10-year period? That's the real threat. That's why we're already, you're right, we're on the edge already. For all these years of a lack of revenue, and a cut is unthinkable. And it's really going to cause such devastation. You see everywhere all the trauma and depression and anxiety and suicidal thinking because of the virus. If we get a second wave, it'll just be even worse. These services need to be in place. The governor has referenced that numerous times, the importance of them. So, we're hoping. He's supposed to give an announcement next week on mental health. We're hoping we'll hear something good.
And what would you like him to say?
In the perfect world, I would like him to say that mental health, as you said earlier, in any environment should be exempt from cuts because of the times we're in. And if anything, we should invest, make smart investments. So that's with the ideal. If you ask me what I'd like to see him say is mental health is so important that if I'm going to cut else somewhere, I'm not going to cut there.
So what do you think, you know, families of these individuals, you know, who have children or a family member with a disability and their housing is going to be cut? Are they going to end up being kicked out of their group home, or what happens to them?
I think there is the threat of that. It's not so much the group homes are not much as threat, I don't think, as the stipends for the apartments. The state, between your Social Security disability and a rent stipend, you can afford what often is a high rent. So if you take away the state stipend, then it's not enough to pay the rent. So the families would either have to pay it, I suppose, or worse could happen. I think the crisis in housing is probably the most dramatic impact of the cuts would be that people would lose their homes. And I think that plays very hard with the governor. He did put money in the budget for housing this year. Again, we're counting on him to do the right thing. We're counting on Washington to do the right thing. And then we're counting on him to do the right thing and protect mental health. And not only mental health, but addiction recovery services as well.
I understand they're being impacted at a time when, you know, all these services are at their most highest need, you know, especially harm reduction type services.
You know, there are numerous epidemics. We talk about the COVID, but there's an addiction and a suicide epidemic and an overdose epidemic as well. And so, you know, it's a terrible sort of combination, and we got to stave off the suicides and the overdoses by funding mental health services.
Before we wrap up, do you have anything else you would like to share with our listeners on these issues of the most vulnerable of New Yorkers being impacted?
I would switch a little bit to the terrible crisis that's been caused by the policing that has caused the deaths of so many people, including Daniel Prude up in Rochester. There's a lot of discussion around reinventing the police, not defunding, I think, but transferring the funds to something more appropriate. And so this idea of sending out our proposal right now is that a mental health counselor or peer counselor, someone like myself who's got a mental illness in recovery, a mental health peer counselor with a trained EMT is who ought to go out first, not a police officer. So we're really pushing on that and hoping that in localities are pushing for it and the state should push for it. We cannot, the police, you know, we've trained the police for decades on mental health. It's just not enough and it's not working. We've got to send someone else out who's more appropriate.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Rosenthal, for your time today, and stay safe.
Thank you. You too, Michelle.
Okay. And this is Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Harvey Rosenthal, CEO of New York State Association of Psychiatric Rehabilitation Services, speaking about the impact of New York State cuts on mental health, disabled, and other vulnerable populations with Michelle Masurgeon, Upstate Housing Correspondent.
David Biggs is a structural engineer who has consulted on archaeological restorations in countries such as Iraq, Egypt, Turkey, Czech Republic, and New Zealand. He is also a lifelong resident of Troy in the Capital District. HMM correspondent Miles Makovsky interviewed Biggs about his career and architecture, both ancient and modern.
Could you tell me about your background, how you got into this very interesting line of work doing ancient archaeological restoration and masonry?
Oh, yes. So I'm raised from Troy, wasn't born there, but I was raised in Troy. Went to school at Rensselaer Polytechnic and educated as a civil engineer with a specialty in structures. Following my education, started going to work for a consulting engineering firm, and ultimately found my way back to Troy and started a company called Ryan Biggs Associates with my partner, Tom Ryan. Most engineers do new design type of work, but we also were being called regularly to look at existing buildings. And at the time, it was not type of work many engineers wanted to do or were interested in, yet it interests us. He had an interest in history, and I did as well. So we started to take on that type of work, and it kind of grew from there. How I got into the more of the ancient work. It was an outgrowth of that. Following 9/11, I was on the FEMA team that actually investigated a World Trade Center disaster. And that led to some invitations to go international to talk about the report that was done on 9/11. And in 2003 or 2007, I made a trip to Egypt at the invitation of the government there to speak. And it led to looking at some historic sites there. And that was 2003, I think. And in 2007, I returned as part of an international team to study many of the temples and monuments throughout Egypt, particularly along the Nile. And this really jump-started the international work. Because of that work in Egypt in 2007, I started to get requests from some of the other consultants who were on that trip. Some were professors, some were consultants from other countries, and it led me into Czech Republic, into Turkey, into Iraq, and it's been kind of just moving along just by word of mouth. So
what sort of temporary build or more recent buildings were you restoring before you were asked to investigate the 9/11 site and all this? And how easily does that transition to the ancient stuff? And what are the differences?
Yeah, well, the investigation techniques, whether it's for investigating a damaged facility or looking at an ancient site, the tools are all about the same. I was actually a little surprised that somebody from Troy, New York, was being asked to go and do these things myself. But I quickly found out that in the Northeast here, we have quite a wealth for us of historic properties. Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception in Albany, Cathedral of All Saints in Albany, the original state education building in Albany, the old train station downtown Albany. We've gotten to work on the Bennington Monument in Bennington, Vermont, historic Fort Ticonderoga. Some of the oldest ones in New York only go back to like the 1650s, but the majority of old, what we think is older or even late 1800s. And being in the Northeast, many of our buildings are exposed to snow and ice and freezing and, you know, minor earthquakes generally, so that we get a real range of effects that go on to these buildings. And I found out that translated quite nicely to working overseas. Many of the countries are much more seismically active than what we have in the Northeast, but you tend to pick that up. But if you've dealt with snow and ice on buildings, you know, going into more arid countries, it's actually sometimes a little bit easier. You don't have that to deal with. You're dealing more with, you know, winds and floods. And I know Cairo was particularly interesting because there was a real problem with groundwater table there and rising water. And, you know, we get some of that even in the Hudson Valley area with the Hudson River flooding in some areas, or having soil conditions that are quite interesting with the clays that we have. So I found out that the Northeast was actually a very good training ground for working overseas.
Do you think that there are any structural lessons that you've seen?
We generally have learned that the structural lessons, you know, of what was done before, they didn't use the science that we use for engineering and architecture the way we do today, but they made very good choices in many cases, you know, and a lot of their building was trial and error. They try something, it doesn't work, they change it. You know, the pyramids were, they came up with many, many tries at doing the pyramids in Egypt before they came up with the exact slope that works. Many of them failed before that because they were too steeply pitched. So they learned by trial and error. We have more science to work with today. what concerns me about the modern architecture is probably more the selection of materials. You know, as you mentioned, you know, I like masonry because it has endured the time. The real monuments are generally made out of masonry. We have today, I'm wondering about some of the materials that we're using. We're going for lesser quality from a resilience standpoint, and will those things last as long, or are we sometimes building disposable buildings?
Is there anything you appreciate especially in, you know, the architecture of Troy or Albany or Saratoga Springs, or that you might want to see more of?
Well, that's interesting. You know, what has always, to me, made the Capital District interesting was the mixture. You know, the early Dutch influences, we still have aspects of that all around. You know, the old buildings in Albany, the oldest buildings are of Dutch origin. If you drive around Albany, many times you look up at the top, and even some of the newer buildings have what looks like a mansard-type roof. You may have noticed that, and that's actually an acknowledgement back to the Dutch influence. So that's still with us. You come into Troy, and you know, we see many, like Washington Park area, the beautiful brownstones and on Fifth Avenue and things like that, which is, you know, you could feel like you're in Boston or New York City, you know, at the same time period. The buildings are very similar. But what I really like about the city is it's maintained much of the old construction. One of the worst things I think the city ever did was during the urban renewal era, from the Green Island Bridge down in Detroit, they tore down many, many of the old buildings. They built the Uncle Sam Mall, the parking garage went up, and then in turn, we lost a lot of wonderful buildings. And the best thing I thought had ever happened was they ran out of money for urban renewal, and they didn't destroy everything, because it was slated that from 3rd Street and Fulton, that intersection along River Street, was going to be torn down. Everything was going to be torn down on the riverside of River Street all the way down to what became the new City Hall back in the 70s. All of that was going to be torn down and rebuilt in a new architectural style. Fortunately, the city ran out of money, and so many of those buildings on River Street, you know, are really cherished now. They're wonderful buildings. They've been brought back to life and they look great, and they give the city a real character that I think truly would have been lost.
So, okay. I forgot about one of the most important things. I was just on the phone with Joe Fama.
Joe Fama, yes.
And he told me to send his regards. So I
agree. Good, good. Yes. Well, the city of Troy has Joe Fama to thank for so much that has been saved at Troy. Joe has been a real leader in protecting the architecture of Troy. So he's the one you should have on the program and talking about Troy.
Well, thank you very much for talking.
Sure. Okay, Miles.
I appreciate it so much.
So that was David Briggs, a structural engineer who has consulted on archaeological digs all around the world, talking a lot about the great architecture here in the Capital District. Wow, what a great segment.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Livonia Mallory. And thank you to our engineer / co-host, Alexis Goldsmith. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org and on our Facebook page at facebook.com/ WOOC 105.3 FM.
And this program. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390. And if you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.